This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I want to give a brief historical perspective. I want to talk about the benefits and challenges that are associated with early detection of autism. I'll be saying autism and ASD interchangeably. Talk about what we know now about the early behavioral features, how whether that matches well with current service delivery systems, and how we might improve detection and intervention and bridge that gap through an expanded use of interactive screening. So, starting with a historical overview, many of you may have seen this. This is the from the Autism Speaks website that is a beautiful portrayal of the autism numbers, the prevalence numbers increasing. So, like Sally said, this is where I came into the picture. Okay, so I started when autism was seen in three or four out of 10,000 children. Okay, this is what, so I'm going to just paint a little picture. Infantile autism was just for the very first time was in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. We're on the fifth one coming up. There was no educational category for autism. Children with autism were served under the other health impaired category. There was one autism journal, JAD, which is still going strong. Researchers and funding were scarce. There just weren't many around. I've got stories to tell about going to conferences and being on a panel, the only one talking about autism, and they would put me last, and everybody would leave the room before. Because it's like, well, that, it doesn't matter to me. Nobody knew what autism was. At that time, it was a lifetime diagnosis, and it was strongly associated with severe intellectual disability. That was how it was thought of. So now, this chart doesn't even go up to the 2012 numbers. So now it's seen in 1 out of 88 children. Certainly, as you know, it's a household word. It gets extensive media coverage. It's well recognized that these kids are very heterogeneous, and not in terms of the behavioral expression as well as their outcomes. And a minority in the latest CDC report, the majority of children with autism do not have intellectual disability. So the whole nature of this disorder and what it looks like, the whole ecology has kind of changed. Within this period of time, between in the 30 or so years, there have been lots of really important developments. And one is a recognition of the importance of early detection, and I'll be talking about that. We've come to realize how effective early intervention can be when it's specialized to the needs and core deficit areas of autism. We've learned more about the early behavioral features of autism. There are screening tools now for young ages, and there are standardized diagnostic tools. So all of these are new, given relative to when the field and my participation in the field started. So let me talk about why I always start this way, why early detection is important. So probably most importantly, early detection provides the key or the ticket to specialized early intervention services, which at this point have been pretty strongly associated with with significant gains in almost all domains of functioning, whether it's social or language or behavioral or cognitive. And this is not something that we saw when we were identifying four-year-olds in the 80s and 90s. We didn't see the kinds of gains that we're seeing now. And the cool thing about it is that this suggests that the core behavioral features of autism are malleable. And that's a really important concept. And it's not inconsistent with what we know from neuroscience and social science research, which suggests that although we come into this world with a genetic template, there's lots of wiggle room within that template, and that wiggle room is partially determined by our experiences and our environments, and that environmental influences, whether they're positive or negative, can really moderate the development, our development. regardless of that genetic template. We also know that the early years of life are the time of rapid brain development and organization. And then we know from economic studies that the provision of positive experiences in early in life is much more effective and less costly than when you try to do corrective intervention at later ages. So you get more bang for your buck at young ages. So this is my little model. Sorry, Sally's probably seen this 700 times, but I like it. If typical development is it's blocks that build upon one another, and there's a solid base, and they build in a nice, steady way. This is what atypical development might look like without intervention. So there's like a little bit of a veering away from the vertical, and then there's a subsequent cascading of development. And we don't want that to happen. Oh, so it's much easier to intervene when this gap is small than when it's larger. So what we want to do is when we see development going kind of awry or askew, we want to intervene then so that the subsequent development can be proceed along as typical a path as possible. So that's our goal. Second reason that early detection is important is for families. And parents of kids with autism, young children, these children can be very perplexing. They look like other kids. They act like other kids most or a lot of the time. But for parents who have other children, there seems to be something different. Or for parents who just see their child compared to their same age peers, they know something is different. It can be very frustrating. It can be very confusing. So by giving them a name for what this is and helping them understand and predict behavior and giving them access to resources, to other families, to intervention strategies, to things that they can do at home during everyday activities, and maybe by then we can promote their understanding, their self-efficacy as a parent, and also reduce any potential negative attributions that they might be making, such as, well, he's a bad kid, or he doesn't like me, or, you know, I'm doing something horribly wrong. So we don't want to get into that cycle. Then the third reason is to understand more about the causes and treatments of autism. If we can study children at very young ages, hopefully we will be able to tease out the core deficit areas from the later emerging developmental sequelae. And if we can do that, we can understand more about developmental trajectories and differences between different subgroups, and hopefully tailor interventions to the specific needs and maybe do some prediction of behaviors later on. And this is an example of this, of how understanding etiology could influence treatment, could inform treatment. So if we assume that autism, that there's a core social impairment that is a critical feature of autism, there are different things that might underlie this. So one is that there could be, children could have this atypical social motivation, and may not be motivated to as much to connect with other people, may not be driven to interaction. And we have seen that through research looking at social orienting and sharing positive affect and social reward systems. And then alternatively, and not these two are not mutually exclusive, it can be due to attentional or sensory processes, as we talked a little bit about earlier. And there have been differences noted in attentional disengagement and sticky attention shifting, and integrating information and binding information from different senses. So it could be that this is an important underlying feature. And the reason it might lead to a core social impairment is if you think of how subtle and complex, like understanding faces is, for example, you have to like match lips up with what you're hearing and facial expressions with what you're hearing and the context, and it's a really challenging chore. So these two, so whether it's one or the other or both, they have different implications for intervention. So if it's a social motivation issue, then you want to really develop strategies so that people are rewarding, so that kids find some reward and enjoyment from interacting. And if it's attentional and sensory, then you want to help kids develop strategies for improving their visual attention or their auditory attention or the coordination between different senses. There have been lots of guidelines and initiatives and directives recommending early intervention, early identification, and early intervention, starting from 2000. And the most American Academy of Pediatrics has been very active and just came out with its second edition of the Autism Toolkit. And so we have, you know, these mandates, and there's understanding that this is important. That's widespread. So, how are we doing with this? Let's see. So here is our timeline. So parents express concern about children's development at about 17 to 18 months. And this is one of the most consistent pieces of research in the autism field. There have been studies for, 20 or 30 years that have all come up with that same age, like when parents first concerns. The average age from the CDC report of when children receive a definitive diagnosis is still 3.5 to 4, and unless you're from a minority family, in which case it's like 5.5. So this is obviously unacceptable, and here is where the early intervention services kick in. And so this window is not the only window within which we can work with children to see great improvements, but it may be the time that's the most efficient. And so look how many kids are missing out from that advantage. And so this is one of the gaps I'm talking about between the first concerns and diagnosis. Well, this is a model that is common, is that somebody has concerns about autism, either from a developmental screening or just an in-law has mentioned concerns to you about your child. And the next step is to get a diagnostic evaluation, and then the next step is to get, if you end up with a diagnosis, is to get autism-specialized intervention. So this is ideally how this model could work, nice smooth flow from arrow to arrow. But there are lots of roadblocks, and there's a literature supporting these. First of all, autism is so commonly known now, that really there's not universal knowledge about the early signs of autism. And there are there's certainly reluctance to label children at young ages. And there's limited use of formal autism-specific screenings in practices. So what happens there is some kids aren't getting referred for the diagnostic evaluation. Then, even by the time they are, there can be really long waits. I'm not going to get into this one. There are lots of reasons for this, but there can be long waits. I mean, we've had waits as long as 9 to 11 months for a 2-year-old, which is crazy. That's like half of their life. So that's gonna prevent timely intervention. And then once they get referred here, there could be limited numbers of intervention specialists who really know about autism. And autism really is different. I mean, these kids have unique needs, unique learning needs, and intervention needs. So the delays in diagnosis that I showed you before really also contribute to delays in getting the intervention that we want to promote early. So reasons for these delays, I mean, there are lots of reasons and lots of complex reasons for the delays. And one of them, not the least of which, is early diagnosis is hard. There are lots of issues surrounding it that I will talk about. The way our current service delivery system works, and also that the science, what we know about early detection and intervention, really hasn't been translated yet into community practice. That takes a long time, and we can talk more about that. So right now, this is like Wendy's take on where we are in terms of early diagnosis. So there's evidence that, there's evidence that it's the diagnosis is reliable in terms of a clinician agreement from about 24 months, and it's better for the more severe children. It's better for making the distinction between autism spectrum and not spectrum than for making any distinction between what are currently the different diagnoses within the spectrum now. It's fairly stable over time after about 30 months. And the stability is better for children who are more impaired than less impaired. But what we don't know a lot right now about the diagnostic reliability and stability under 24 months, much as we would like to and much as we try. And we also really don't know why some kids improve, like why there is two children who might look very similar at 18 months in terms of having autism symptoms can show such divergent pathways, and with one improving dramatically to subclinical levels and the other proceeding along that path. And we don't know about the natural course versus intervention as whether they are causal. We don't know about risk protective factors, and we don't know if the kids that we're seeing now compared to the kids that we saw in the 80s are, you know, how those cohorts of children differ. So just to add to this timeline, which is going to get very busy in a minute. So here is kind of where the diagnosis achieves stability. So that you know, throws a wrench into the works. Okay, so if the diagnosis isn't stable, but we want to provide early intervention, you know, what do we do? So you gotta stay here for the end. So as you know, we have a new DSM coming out this year, and there are three criteria, and one is impairments in social communication and interaction, and those are two that were smushed together, and I'm going to start with that one, and the other is restricted and repetitive activities. So this first one, you will note, has the description is deficits. So these are things that kids don't show or don't show regularly, and that makes it really hard. It's hard to see what isn't there, especially in an office visit when, you know, young kids are, you know, they act differently according to whether they're tired or maybe don't feel well. Their self-regulation ain't so great. So in terms of negative symptoms, I mean, it's just harder than positive symptoms that are like things you see. Also, parents of children with autism are really good at bringing out the children's best behaviors. They figure out how to interact with their child. They figure out how to get a response. And they don't always realize what they're doing and what they have to do to get it. And then, like, what is social reciprocity and how do you measure it and what are our social norms? Well, we don't have social norms for this. We know when you're supposed to walk. We know when you're supposed to talk. But when are you supposed to smile responsively or look between a person and an object or imitate certain things? I mean, we really don't have those internal milestones for that. Not only that, but social communicative behavior is not an all or nothing thing. So it isn't that these behaviors are completely absent. Children with autism do show social behavior. They can have eye contact. They can imitate. They can be attached to caregivers. But what we're seeing is less consistency across people and across settings, or you may see behaviors at unexpected times. And clearly, they often require greater effort to extract these behaviors. And so it's more a qualitative thing sometimes than a quantitative thing. And there are subtle differences in terms of timing and synchrony and things that are very hard to elaborate. So how do these things play out in young children? So in children I'm talking about 2-year-olds. We know most about that age group. So these are things that we don't see as much of, or we see inconsistently. So sharing enjoyment, imitating, showing off, initiating and responding to social games. So those are the kinds of things that we don't see. But it's not like we never see them. It's just that it's just not the same as with other children. The second diagnostic criteria is developing and maintaining relationships. So you don't expect a whole lot of a 2-year-old in terms of peer empathy or friendship. You expect them to show some social interest. You expect them to imitate. And every now and then you expect to see some interactive play. So these are things, again, that we don't see that much in young children with autism. And then the third criterion for the DSM is the use of nonverbal forms of communication. And I'm going to talk separately about requesting which is communicating for something you want, and directing attention or joint attention, which is communicating just for the social pleasure of communicating because you want to interact and you want to share your interest with another person. So for requesting, kids can request, they reach to be picked up by their parents, they reach for things they want, they point to things that they want, and these are behaviors, again, these are negative symptoms, so you don't necessarily see these as often or as regularly in children with autism. And you may see things like this where a child will put an adult's hand on an object when they want help, or pull their parent to a door. This one is to leave the testing room, but also to go to the kitchen if they want something. And this is my favorite example. This is a child who literally used his mother as a chair. So these do not have social intent, and this is the most extreme. I mean, he literally he wanted that. He sees this little yellow and red bubble gun. He wanted the bubble gun, and it was. I mean, he is holding on to her hair for support. So this is my favorite example of non-social form of requesting. Now, directing the other non-verbal function of communication is directing attention, which is a much more social. And this you hardly see at all in the young children with autism. So what you don't see, but other kids do show, is pointing to say, look at that, isn't that cool? You know, and it's usually a point looking back at the adult, showing, holding up things to show, just for the sake of like informing somebody that I'm interested in this and you should be too. And then lots of different kinds of facial expressions, and often combined with gestures. So in the restricted and repetitive pattern of behavior category, there are four different criteria, and you actually need to meet two. You need to meet all three of the social and two of these, unless they changed it, but I think that's still correct. So so children can have fixated interest. This child, whenever he saw wheels, he would go to great efforts to spin them and look at them very closely, whether it's a stroller that he would flip upside down or a toy car or truck like this. Rigid routines, so having to play with this puzzle in the same way each time, lining up these pieces probably in the same order each time, and getting really upset if someone came over and interrupted this routine. The stereotype movements, they're hard to get photos of. So this is a hand flapping one, but you try it. Not on video, but it's still. And different kinds of sensory interests. And this is in the DSM for the first time. But so this is a child who really liked the feel of that funny kind of ball with the stringy things. These other two children really like to look at things closely and would do that for a long time. Now, I can't leave this slide without adding these. Does anybody know what these are? These are red herrings. And this is thank you for knowing whoever I knew. It's like, because if a child only has these behaviors are easy to see. You know, they look different. They set kids apart. But if you just have these behaviors, it is not autism. It is not autism. And I think there's still a lot of misconception about that in the community. And so if you just see, so that's the red herring. If you see these behaviors in the absence of social, they don't mean anything on their own. Okay. So when we go to even younger ages, we try to go below two, it's even harder. And infants, as you go into infancy, there's just much less self-regulation, much more behavioral variability. There are overlapping symptoms with other disorders. The behavioral repertoire isn't as great. So there's lots of so behaviors can mean different things. Children can have a language delay, or can have a more global developmental delay, or may have autism, and it may look the same at early ages. In the past, the DSM diagnostic criteria have focused on older children. So the criteria haven't in the past made as much sense for the very young children. And as this group here has identified, there are very different patterns of onset. So it's like you can't count on, you know, a child looking a certain way, and that means that it's going to be autism. So here's my picture of this. Sally, you can borrow this if you want sometime. So if this is typical development, it's a nice, you know, month gain per month of life. Some children with autism seem to be developing typically and then they kind of plateau. Others seem to be developing typically and then have a regression and a loss of skills. And others just seem to be delayed in some way just throughout from early on. So depending on when you're looking at them, they can look very similar or they can look more different. So one of the ways that we have tried to understand the earliest features of autism is by studying infant siblings. And it's been a very exciting area of research. This, I will say, I will brag that this is our child from Vanderbilt up on there. And she walked into her five-year evaluation carrying the Newsweek cover, and she was fine. So studying it made a lot of sense to start studying younger siblings because we knew from previous research that siblings of children with autism were more likely to have features of autism. So it's putting them at risk. It enables us to, you don't have to wait till a child fails a screening, but you can start looking at kids prospectively from birth if you want. We can not just understand risk for ASD, but also for components of what might be more subclinical symptoms or the broader phenotype. We can look at developmental course, including understanding more about regression. We can look at and think about how behavior may map onto potential biological or genetic mechanisms, and not the least, but we can also assist families through this process. Parents who have older children with autism and a new baby can have many different reactions. Some could be very, very vigilant, and some could not want to even think of the idea of this new baby also having autism. But it's very helpful to conduct longitudinal studies. These families really, I think, appreciate it, just getting the input and the feedback along the way so that if they need assistance, then they can get it as soon as possible. There are two types of sibling studies, actually more than two, but I'm going to talk about two. And one is the prospective follow-up where we're identifying children at risk and we're following them up either to the time of diagnosis, and it could be autism or it could be another disorder. Another aspect of the prospective follow-up is looking at early behaviors and processes and seeing how they relate to later behaviors, whether or not it's diagnosis. But are these early behaviors important? And you know, maybe they are, but maybe they aren't. Maybe they don't correlate with anything. But looking like, are they related? Are early challenges in social behavior development related to later issues in social communication? And then the second type are comparing high-risk siblings to low-risk siblings as a group. And this is how we all started because we didn't have follow-up data yet because you have to wait till kids are 36 months to get their diagnosis. So we all start by looking at whether these groups of very young siblings look different from one another. So from this we can learn how this group at elevated genetic risk differs from their low-risk peers on different behavioral or neurobiological measures. And then we can maybe think about what it can tell us about what it means to be in a family with other affected individuals. So what we've learned a lot, and in part because of the Baby SIBS Research Consortium, which is funded by Autism Speaks, has been funded for, I don't know, 10 years, and has really facilitated research with larger numbers than we've been able to do in any group alone. And there have been two really important such. I would like to, you to know I made this slide myself. And I had to, like, read how to make a slide because they changed the Windows thing, so I didn't know how to do it because they took the little picture off of the main screen. So I am most proud of this. So you can criticize anything else, but do not criticize this. If I were really good, I would have, like, had the wedges come in individually, but I could not do that. It was too much. But anyway, so one of the baby sibs studies looked at from the pool of high-risk individuals, how many ended up with a diagnosis of autism spectrum at the age of 3, and that was the one. Sally was the lead author on that. And it turned out it was like 18.7, or it's just like I rounded up to about 19%. And then a later study compared the non-affected, so the green plus everyone but the blue, looked at that sample, and these are like hundreds are in these samples, looked at that sample to see, it was a complex study, but it looked at how many kids were in groups that represented either higher symptoms or lower cognitive levels relative to typical controls, and found that that's an additional 20%. Okay, so we've got, you know, so this is like a big chunk of this, of the infant siblings who have something. And I think it's, you know, for me, it's a call to action. But 61% are unaffected, so that's the good news. And then if you happen to be male, or if you happen to have more than one sibling, then your risk is elevated for a less optimal outcome. So these were really important findings. And this was the first, almost one in five for a recurrence risk for autism. I mean, this was much higher than we had thought from earlier genetic studies. We had lots of different questions that we can ask from these studies. One, from prospective studies. One is, do early behaviors predict later ASD outcomes for these high-risk children? And this is where we are, as far as I can tell, with this research right now. So there's strong evidence that by 12 to 18 months, that social orienting and response to joint attention, I mean, these are replicated results. So those, to me, are there's the strongest evidence for that. By a little bit later, somewhere between 12 and 24 months, the use of gestures seems to predict. And then there's less strong support for atypical object use and unusual body use. But so we're getting to recognize these. And so these are the same behaviors that we're seeing at older ages. So it's nothing new. But it does suggest that, well, maybe, you know, we can start thinking of these as risk factors. There haven't been replicated findings of markers, potential markers, at 6 months. So we have, like, by 12 months, but we don't know really when this starts. All right, second question for prospective sibling studies is, do developmental trajectories predict ASD outcomes? So does the rate of development predict? And there is some good evidence from here and from multiple sites for cognitive decline or cognitive slowing sometime during the first 24 months. And then a really interesting study here. I don't know that this has been replicated elsewhere, but a decrease in social interest and interaction between 6 and 12 to 18 months. So that's really interesting, and that's so it does look like that, you know, it is. And so one of the really important, I think, take-home messages is that it's nice to study behaviors at a point in time, but it's really interesting to study behaviors as they grow and change over time, and that could be a really important aspect of early detection. A third type of prospective study is whether early behaviors predict later behaviors. Because this is, you know, so maybe it doesn't matter if a child doesn't direct attention. You know, if they're still learning, if they learn language just when other kids do. So we want to know things like that. So in this study, this did come out of our lab, followed children up from 15 months to 5 years, and found that early joint attention does predict social communication skills to age 5. that actually the prediction is the same for high-risk siblings as it is for low-risk siblings, and that there were differences according to the type of joint attention. So if the children initiated joint attention for that measure, it was the initial, it was how they did at 15 months predicted their language later on. And for responding to joint attention or following a point, it was the extent to which they gained in skills in responding to joint attention between 15 and 24 months that then predicted, or 34 months to age 5. So again, emphasizing that sometimes it's developmental trajectory and not just single time point. And it really matters when we measure. If we had gone earlier than 15 months, it could have been the trajectory of initiating joint attention and not just the time point. So it's really important in thinking about these studies and comparing them to see what age this was measured. Another example of this is something that was just submitted that showed that gaze shifting during the face-to-face still face predicts social communication skills at 12 months. So this is this was interesting in that it's an early behavior, and we predicted that if your ability to shift gaze to and from your mom during the still face task, where it's a dyadic interaction, might predict your ability to engage in triadic communication, which is what joint attention is. And so we measured, at 12 months, we measured responding to joint attention and expressive language. And we found, this is what we found. After like putting Sally's name in this, and I feel like I'm talking more about her research, so I put these in so you know that we actually do research there. So this, if you look at the left, wait, I'm going to point with this. There, look, the left side, there was a stronger these correlations were only true for the high-risk siblings. So this one is that gaze shifting, predicting, responding to joint attention at 12 months, and the next one is gaze shifting, predicting, expressive language. So that's, so I think these behaviors are important. I think that's what this tells us. And individual differences in these behaviors are may be important for individual differences later on. The second type of study compares high-risk siblings to low-risk siblings as groups. And, almost any study that has been done will find some differences within the first and second years of life between these two groups in cognitive, behavioral, social communicative domains, any domain. And the differences are found both by for parent report measures and observational. So it's like a really robust set of findings. But what we don't know is, well, what do these differences mean? And how are they stable? Are they going to, the difference is going to be maintained over time? Which of them predict a later diagnosis? Do these differences mean anything other than diagnosis? And what do we do? I mean, do we intervene? Do we try to do prevention? And certainly we need to follow these samples up to know. So for repetitive and stereotype movements, we did a study where at 15 months, high-risk siblings had more repetitive and stereotype movements than low-risk, and they were matched on mental age, which is important because mental age has been shown to relate to repetitive behaviors. So this group had higher rates. The rates are still low, but they're significantly higher. And then when we followed them up to the age of diagnosis, the children who ended up with the diagnosis didn't have any more than the children who didn't. So this was not helpful in identifying which children were going to get a diagnosis. These are very small numbers, acknowledged. Even the children who didn't get, who were high risk and didn't get a diagnosis were still much higher significantly higher than the low risk kids. So this seems to be a behavior that is common, maybe in, it needs to be replicated, but could be common in the behavioral repertoire for some reason and for related to the genetic vulnerability, perhaps, but not necessarily predictive of a diagnosis. So to summarize these studies, about 40% have suboptimal outcomes at age 3. Social communicative behaviors and slowing trajectories within the first 18 months may be risk factors. Individual differences in early behaviors are predictive of later social communicative development. And early group differences between high risk and low risk may not mean that there's going to be a diagnosis later on, but it may just reflect their different risk status or genetic status. So, given this information, so I just added one more complication to the trial. So this is like when symptom emergence. So although, yeah, we can't diagnose, you know, the diagnosis isn't necessarily stable, but this is when the symptoms are emerging. So another read, like, you know, you can argue, oh, no, don't do it. Oh, yes, do it. You know, early yes, early no, because we don't know for sure. So it's, this is like the tension that we have. It's like, do we, you know, what do we do? Okay. So this was going back to this model. This was the diagnosis intervention model. So given the challenges of early diagnosis, the presence of early behavioral risk factors, and the importance of early intervention, should we shift to a risk prevention model? Okay, and this is kind of the, usually I just like stop there, but I'm going further this time. So this is a risk I am taking here. I trust you. So, and what I'm referring to, I'm conceptualizing this as an expanded use of screening. And what it could look like is somebody has concerns about autism. Somebody, a community provider, uses an interactive screen, which will indicate, oh, this child is at risk, and will also indicate, oh, these are behaviors that we can work with, because the interactive screen can look at core behaviors. They can start intervention. So they're getting to this endpoint, but they don't have a diagnosis yet. But you're still referring for the diagnostic evaluation. This is like while you wait. So it could look like this. So you conduct an interactive screen, you develop intervention and goals in core deficit areas, you implement preventive intervention, and you assess progress. And hopefully you're working with parents and helping them do these things. Okay, so benefits are you're providing children with specialized intervention while they're waiting for the diagnosis. You're getting started. You're helping parents. People who work in birth to three systems say that the parents are like high anxiety the whole time because they don't have closure on whether this child has a diagnosis because they can't get the diagnosis. It can help them move forward and learn skills. We're capitalizing on early brain plasticity, and we can increase provider knowledge of early signs by teaching them these interactive screens and what to look for. There are lots of other risk prevention models, medical, think about cardiovascular disease, where you want to prevent heart attack and stroke. So we want to screen for risk factors. We prevent by telling them to make lifestyle changes. And then, you know, if more intervention is needed, we provide it. So for autism, you want to prevent functional impairment. We know some risk factors. We can provide a less intensive intervention that would be parent training, and then more intensive as needed. So there's an educational risk prevention model, the responsiveness to intervention, where you identify children at risk, you provide a less intensive strategy, you monitor progress, provide a transition to more intensive services as needed. There's an early childhood risk prevention model. So this isn't like a new idea, but it is a change to the delivery system. So what I know best, what we've been doing is using the STAT, and you could do this with other things, but this is the one that I know. So it does have strong psychometric properties as a level 2 screen in referral settings. There are 12 activities, it takes 20 minutes, and it provides a standard context and looks at core social behaviors. So we look at requesting, directing attention, motor imitation, and play. So what you see during this interaction is stuff, so you know what to work on. These are the core social deficits. So if you're using it for screening, you score items, pass, fail, and then you get a total score, and then you compare that to a cutoff. If you're using it for goal setting, you're looking at what the child is doing during these items and to identify strengths and needs, and then you can develop activities. So here's where interactive screening can fit in the model. I think it's not a diagnosis. It's not a full intervention. It's getting a start. It's like intermediate between when you're worried and when you know. That's all.
Have you ever seen instances where, and I know it's kind of controversial, I'm not trying to say it's the cold, frigid mother or anything like that, but when some of the social exchanges that children do try to initiate, you know, that starts to get less when it's not reinforced?
I think we know, you know, we know some of that from looking at children of parents who are depressed, and
right.
and yes, behavior can change. However, it's important to think about the number of adults in that child's environment. And I think if one person doesn't reinforce it, I think there are lots of opportunities within the ecology of the child's life to get that reinforcement. But also in response to that, I mean, there are some parents who don't want to, they don't like getting on the floor and playing. They're not comfortable doing that. That's not what they want to do. So this is, you know, I don't think you can, you know, make somebody, you know, interact in that way if they're, you know, they may prefer table activities and more directed kind of things.
I have a large group of adult ASD, and they're usually referred to me as psychiatrists for treatment of violence. Are there any early behavioral markers that are predictive of later violence in this population?
Interesting question, and I don't know of any research that has looked at that. We're having a hard enough time predicting to age five, and much less to anything in adulthood. But you know, certainly like self-regulation issues could come into play. But I think there's just a myriad of factors that contribute to that, from which behaviors are reinforced or not extinguished at which time. I mean, there's so many things that could contribute to that. But it's a good question. It's an interesting question. I don't think we know with kids without autism in conduct disorder why it emerges always. So it's a tricky one.
I know you mentioned the one kid that who is put stacking the blocks up in a certain way, and that if he gets his routine messed with, he gets upset. I have a lot of patients, if their routine,
right.
their daily routine or whatever right. ritual they're doing, if it gets interrupted, that's when they blow.
Right, right. And I have to, you know, this is where I really feel so strongly that early intervention can make a difference in teaching flexibility and teaching self-regulation. I mean, I really think that we can make a big impact, because it gets, you know, it gets harder when they're older, because the behaviors are more embedded and they're self reinforcing. I mean, you usually, you know, get out of what you don't want to do by engaging in an aggressive behavior. So, yeah.
I just have a question about the rise in incidence. I don't work with autism spectrum kids, but I want to know what is the theory behind the rise in incidence? Is it better detection skills, or is actual increase in the population?
So, okay, good question. We don't know its incidence is rising. These are all prevalence numbers, so it's how many at a given point in time exist. So that's different, because we don't have, I haven't seen data on incidence, because you don't know at birth, so it's a little bit more challenging. And the diagnosis can come and go. So, but there are, you know, yeah, there are lots of potential contributions to it. One is certainly more greater awareness, so we know that it exists. There are more services, so we know not only it exists, but we can also, you know, there's something we can do. We're also, the diagnostic criteria have become more less restrictive over the years. I believe that is true. And also we're including more younger kids into the numbers. So those are, you know, so those are the contributing factors that people will talk about. Whether that accounts for the rise is not clear. And, you know, I think people are really looking to environmental exposures more than ever before. I think vaccines isn't something, you know, that's where we moved from there, but are looking at the many things that we encounter in our everyday lives is one possible option.
So have you developed any protocols similar to the samples that you gave, modeling, simple language and things like that, specifically for flexibility? Or anything else that sounds like you're excited about sharing?
I know. Did you see me change?
When
you said flexibility. It's like, oh, come on. Yeah, actually. So we just got a state grant to that's going to enable us to manualize this. So you do, it'll be a two-day training. We'll do two-day trainings. One is on how to do the stat, and the other is on how to take the information from the stat and do this stuff. So I'm really excited about that. And then part of that, we'll be able to develop a video library and we'll be able to manualize, okay, this, you know, if you get, here are some ideas for this. In terms of, you know, there are lots of different strategies for flexibility from, you know, modeling different uses of toys and getting children interested in different kinds of toys and teaching different actions to setting up a schedule and changing things on the schedule and having a card that means there's going to be a change. So there, I mean, so there are some nice strategies for that.
I was just wondering if you, throughout your time working with children with autism, my child was diagnosed at 2, and since he's been diagnosed, he's been in intervention from like day 1. He's doing really good, but he's also been seen by an SLP, and he also has a neurologist. His neurologist doesn't think he's autistic. The SLP thinks he has apraxia, and I was just wondering if, or developmental apraxia, not acquired. So I was just wondering, in your experience, how often do you see that children end up with the diagnosis of apraxia? Because the SLP told me that she'd want to wait until he was like 5 to give the official diagnosis of having that. So I'm just wondering, how common is that they're together? Is it a misdiagnosis because they have similar symptoms?
No, that's a good question too, and it's hard. So I know apraxia is kind of, you have to watch it over time.
Yeah.
So which makes it hard. Some kids with autism do. I mean, there's no evidence that children with autism are less likely to have a dyspraxia than other children. But I haven't seen necessarily a higher. I don't. Somebody else might know better. I haven't seen that it's like a, you know, definitely a, you know, associated with autism. But it could, they could certainly co-occur. And motoric issues are becoming to be recognized as part of an issue associated with autism. So that could affect the muscles in the mouth. It could affect coordination of during acts of imitation and things like that. So it's not a crazy idea.
Hi, Wendy, I think Stuart Mostofsky and Deborah Dewey's work would demonstrate an increased dyspraxia in autism compared to other developmental disorders, although that's not necessarily apraxia of speech.
Okay,
right. No, I understand that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But I think there's
I've seen more of the non-speech motoric involvement than the speech.
I have a question about implementing the screening that you showed us. I mean, how do you conceptualize that for ordinary healthcare workers, pediatricians, daycare centers, how would you like to see it implemented?
Okay. So we've been doing trainings on the STAT for like a jillion years, but we don't, and it's we have a 1-day training workshop, and then there's also a web-based tutorial that you can take to learn it. For the workshop, you send in tapes and you get certified, and then for so that all, you know, all different types of professionals have participated in that, or service providers have participated in that. And then we have this other STAT-MD training that's different and is a 2-day, and it includes things like not just the STAT training, but also how to use incidental observations and how to put together incidental behavioral observations and behavioral observations from the STAT and parent interviewing into like a DSM framework and making diagnostic decisions or assessments or formulating impressions based on that and how to bill and code for it. So that's another type of training that we've done. But interestingly, we've more and more developmental behavioral pediatricians are just coming to the regular STAT training, which is that's been interesting to me. So
from a public health standpoint, do you have an image in your mind of how this could be encouraged, become part of the regular health?
This kind of screen, well, it can, I know it can't be, well, so yeah. So another thing that we have, one model could be, and that we've done in Tennessee, and that other states have been trained, but I don't know if they're going to do that, is training pediatricians who are interested in this to do the stat, you know, so they would, you know, this is not a normal kind of thing that DBPs do, but to spend a half a day a month or a half a day a week or whatever doing these assessments and serving as a regional consultant. So a physician is worried, they send them to this regional consultant who then makes a determination and sends them back and saying, well, yeah or no, or watch this, or, you know, here are some ideas for you. So that's one potential model. And I think just through birth to three programs, getting more people trained, and that's, you know, that's one of the things that we're going to be doing. And then, you know, actually collecting data is like, well, what is happening now, and what do we want to happen, and is there a change, and are they using it? And so we don't know. You know, we've done so many trainings, but I don't, you know, we don't really follow up on, you know, how it's being. Well, we do have some data from the people who have done the tutorial on how they're, but we've just lost track over the years. It's hard to go back and ask people because it was 10 years ago. So so I think some data collection is in order to answer that question. But I think there are some models that would make sense.
Wendy, I have a question. I'm thinking to one of your earlier slides where you talked about the possible contributions to autism, and on one side was, you know, social issues, and the other side was sensory issues, right? So perhaps that's, you know, some of what's underlying some of the disorder. And when you think about treatment goals, do you ever think about those sensory issues as being part of the treatment goals and not just this, you know, sort of hitting on the social aspects, the looking at the mother and the interacting and handing objects? But have you done some thinking in your own treatment work about if that was really part of the etiology, how would some of that be targeted in treatment?
Right. Well, yeah, I think about it a lot. But have I done anything? No. But I feel confident that there are ways of helping, you know, it depends what the goal is and depends what the issue is, and I don't really know, but I really, and I guess I think of it as the, and I hate to say this, but the Paula Talal stuff with the, where you kind of stretch out, for language learning, like stretch out the stimuli so that kids learn it, and then you can shorten it gradually. I know, in my gut, that there are ways to do that, but I don't think we know enough about what the issue is to get there. But I think, you know, they wouldn't, you know, they would be, you know, stuff that you would do probably in front of like a biofeedback-y thing, like in front of a screen with reinforcement for hearing something or looking at both the right thing or something like that. But I it's fun to think about.
The UC Davis Mind Institute was created in 1998 with a promise to find cures for neurodevelopmental disorders. Every day, our physicians and researchers come closer to fulfilling that promise. Their groundbreaking research on autism, Fragile X syndrome, chromosome 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, ADHD, and other brain disorders are helping children achieve their fullest potential. Please visit our website to find out more about current studies, upcoming events, and how you can help make a difference.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.